Welcome to the Frontside Podcast, the place where we talk about user interfaces and everything that you need to know to build them right.
All right, so I think it's actually really nice, Rich, and I'm really, really happy to have a chance to actually chat with you about this, because Svelte is it's a really fun piece of technology, and like it's in many ways interesting to see like our technology evolve and like our industry evolve through innovation, real innovation. I think Svelte 3 has really been kind of that next thought-provoking technology that kind of makes us think about different ways that we can approach problems in our space. So really excited to chat with you about this stuff.
Well, thank you. Excited to be here.
I think quite a lot of people know, Rich, about your history, like how you got into what you're doing now. But I think just, I'm not sure if Charles is aware, so if you could kind of give us a little bit of a lowdown on where you kind of come from in terms of your technical background and such.
Sure, I'll give you the 30-second life history. I started out as a reporter at a financial news organization. I had a philosophy degree and didn't know what else to do with it, so I went into journalism. This was around the time of the Great Recession, and within a few weeks of me joining this company, like I watched half of my colleagues get laid off, and it's like, shit, I need to make myself more employable. And so gradually sort of took on more and more technical responsibilities until I was writing JavaScript as part of my day job. And from there, all these opportunities kind of opened up. And the big thing that I had in mind was building interactive pieces of journalism, that, you know, data-driven, personalized, all of that sort of thing, which were being built at places like the New York Times and the Guardian and the BBC. That was the reason that I really wanted to get into JavaScript. And that's guided my career path ever since.
It's interesting in this, like, D3 and all that did come out of journalism.
It's not a coincidence, because when you're working under extreme time pressure and, you know, you're not building things with a view to maintaining them over a long period of time, like, you just need to build something and get it shipped immediately. But it needs to be built in a way that is going to work across a whole range of devices. We've got native apps, we've got AMP, we've got, you know, our own website. And in order to do all that, you need to have tools that really guide you into the pit of success. And D3 is a perfect example of that. And a lot of people have come into JavaScript through D3.
And so are you still working for the same company?
No. That's ancient history at this point.
Because I'm wondering, are you actually getting to use like these tools that you've been building to actually do the types of visualizations and stuff that we've been talking about?
Very much so. I moved to The Guardian some years ago, and then from there, moved to Guardian US, which has an office in New York. And it was there that I started working on Svelte. I then moved to the New York Times, and I'm still working on Svelte. And I've used it a number of times to build things at the New York Times. Other people have built things with it too. It's very much informed by the demands of building high-performance interactive applications on a very tight deadline.
Okay. Cool. So I probably used, I'm an avid reader of both Guardian and the New York Times, so I probably used a bunch of these visualizations. I had no idea what was driving them. I just assumed it was all D3.
There is a lot of D3. So Mike Bostock, the creator of D3, he was a linchpin of the graphics department for many years. Unfortunately, we didn't overlap. He left the Times before I joined the Times, but his presence is still very much felt in the department. And a lot of people who are entering the industry, they're still becoming data viz practitioners by learning from D3 examples. It's been a hugely influential thing in our industry.
What is how long is a typical project? Like, how long would it take to put together a visualization for an article that you typically see?
It varies wildly. The graphics desk is about 50 strong, and they will turn around things within a day. Like when the Notre Dame burnt down a couple of months ago, my colleagues turned around this interactive, scroll-driven WebGL 3D reconstruction of how the fire spread through the cathedral in less than 24 hours, which was absolutely mind-blowing. But at the same time, there are projects that will take months. I work on the investigations team at the Times, and so I'm working with people who are investigating stories for, you know, the best part of a year or sometimes more, and I'm building graphics for those. And so that, you know, it's two very different timescales, but you need to be able to accommodate all of those different possibilities.
So what does the software development practice look like? I mean, because it sounds like, you know, some of this stuff, are you just throwing it together? I guess what I mean by that is, you know, I guess in the projects that we typically work on, 3 months is kind of the minimum that you would yeah. expect. So you go into it making sure, like, we need to make sure we've got good collaboration practices around, you know, source control and continuous integration and testing and all this stuff. But I mean, you're talking about compressing that entire process into a matter of hours. So what do you just throw right out the window? What do you say, you know, we're just doing a light version of this?
Our collaboration processes consist of sitting near each other and, you know, when the time calls for it, getting in the same room as each other and just hammering stuff out on a laptop together. There's no time for messing around with, you know, continuous integration and writing tests. Like, no one writes tests for news graphics. It's just not a thing.
Right. But then you have, for those projects that stretch into like 3 months, I imagine there are some, you know, do you run into like quality concerns or things like that where you do have to take into account some of those practices? Or I'm just so curious because it sounds like there's actually, you know, the difference between 2 hours and 2 months is, you know, that's several orders of magnitude and complexity of what you're developing.
It is. Although I haven't worked on a news project yet that has involved tests. And I know that's a shocking admission to a lot of people who have a development background, but it's just not part of the culture. And I guess the main difference between the code base for a 2-hour project and a 2-month project is that the 2-month project will strive to have some reusable components. And that's, I think, the main thing that I've been able to get out of working on the kinds of projects that I do is, instead of just throwing code at the page until it works, we actually have a bit of time to extract out common functionality and make components that can be used in subsequent interactives. So things like scroll-driven storytelling, that's much easier for me now than it was when I first built a scroll-driven storytelling mm-hmm. component like a couple of years ago.
Yeah. I mean, that was actually literally my next question is, how do you bridge that, given that you've got kind of this frothy experimentation, but you've got, you know, you are being, sounds like, very deliberate about extracting those tools and extracting those common components. And how do you find the time to even do that?
Well, this is where the component-driven mindset comes in really handy, mm-hmm. I think. Like, I think that, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, when people thought in terms of libraries and scripts, there wasn't like that good unit of reusability that wasn't sort of all-encompassing. Like, a component is just the right level of atomicity, or whatever the word is. It makes sense to have things that are reusable but also very easy to tweak and manipulate and adapt to your current situation. And so I think that the advent of component-oriented development is actually quite big for those of us working in this space, and it hasn't really caught on yet to a huge degree, because, like I say, a lot of people are still coming with this kind of D3 script based mindset, because, you know, the news industry, for some interesting and historical reasons, is slightly out of step with mainstream web development in some ways. Like, we don't use things like Babel a lot, for example.
I mean, that makes sense, right? I mean, the online print is not, it's not like it's a React application, or it's not like it's all in, the application is all encompassing, right? So you really need to have a light footprint, I would imagine, right? Because it really is a script. What you're doing is scripting in the truest sense of the word, right? Where you've got, you know, you essentially have a whole bunch of content, and then you just need to kind of...
Yeah. And the light footprint that you mentioned is key, because, like most new sites, we have analytics on the page, and we have ads, and we have comments, and all of these things that involve JavaScript. And by the time our code loads, all of this other stuff is already fighting for the main thread. And so we need to get in there as fast as we can and do our work with a minimum of fuss. We don't have the capacity to be loading big frameworks and messing about on the page. So that, again, is one of these sort of downward pressures that kind of enforces a certain type of tool to come out of the news business.
Like, a lot of the tooling that's available, especially on the really fatter, bigger frameworks, the tools that you get with those frameworks, they benefit you over long term. So if you have like a long-running project, the weight of the abstractions, you've experienced that benefit over time, and it adds up significantly. But if you're working to ship something in a day, you want something that is just like a chisel, you know, it does exactly what you want it to do. You want to apply it in exactly the right place, and you want to get it done exactly, like you want the outcome to be precise.
That's true. And I think a lot of people who have built large React apps, for example, or large Ember apps, they sort of look at Svelte and think, well, maybe this isn't going to be applicable to my situation because it has this bias towards being able to very quickly produce something. And I'm not convinced that that's true. I think that if you make something easier to get started with, then you're just making it easier. Mm. If you build something that is, you know, simple for beginners to use, then you're also building something simple for experts to use. And so I don't necessarily see it as a trade-off. I don't think we're trading long-term maintainability for short-term production, but it is certainly a suspicion that I've encountered from people.
This is something that we've also encountered recently. It's been kind of a brewing discussion inside of FrontSide about the fact that it seems to be that certain problems are actually better to rewrite than they are to maintain or refactor towards an end goal. So, and we found this especially the tools that we create have gotten more precise and more refined and simplified and lighter. It is actually, you know, it's easier to rewrite those things five times than it is to refactor it one time to a particular place that we want it to be.
Strong agree.
Yeah, and it's interesting that I find this to be a very recent kind of this idea is blossoming in my mind very recently. I didn't observe this in the past.
Do you mean in the sense that like if a tool is focused enough and a tool is simple enough, then refactoring is tantamount to a rewrite? You know, if you're talking about 200 or 300 lines of code, is that what you mean?
Yeah. Because you're sitting down to if you're sitting down to make a change, you have something in mind. It is actually easy to say, let's just start from scratch, and then we're going to get exactly the same place in the same amount of time. But this kind of mantra of not rewriting, it makes me think about that. It makes me question whether that's actually something that is always the right answer.
I definitely question that conventional wisdom at all levels as well. I started a bundler called Rollup as well as Svelte more recently. And Rollup was the second JavaScript bundler that I wrote because the first one that I wrote wasn't quite capable of doing the things that I wanted. And it was easier to just start from scratch than to try and shift the existing user base of its predecessor over to this new way of doing things. Svelte 3 is a more or less complete rewrite. Svelte has had multiple more or less complete rewrites. Some of them weren't breaking changes, but Svelte itself was a rewrite of an earlier project that I'd started in 2013. And so in my career, I've benefited massively from learning from having built something, but then when the time comes and you realize that you can't change it in the ways that you need to change it, just rewrite it. And I think that at the other end of the spectrum, the recent debate about micro front ends has largely missed this point. People think that the benefit of micro front ends is that people don't need to talk to each other, which is absolute nonsense. I think the benefit of this way of thinking about building applications is that it optimizes for this fact of life that we all agree is inevitable, which is that at some point you're going to have to rewrite your code. And we spend so much energy trying to optimize for the stability of a code base over the long term, and in the process, lock ourselves into architectural and technical decisions that don't necessarily make sense 3 or 4 years down the line. And I think as an industry, we'd be a lot better placed if we all started thinking about how to optimize for rewrites. Mm.
So for those of us who aren't familiar, what is the debate surrounding micro front ends? This is actually something I've heard a lot about, but I've actually never heard what micro front ends actually are.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, I don't really have a dog in this fight because, you know, I'm not building products. But the nub of it is that typically if you're building a website that has, I don't know, maybe it has like an admin page, maybe it has a settings page, maybe it has product pages, whatever. Traditionally, these would all be parts of a single monolithic application. The micro front-end approach is to say, well, this team is going to own the settings page. This team is going to own the product page. And they can use whatever technologies they want to bring that about. And the detractors sort of attack a straw man version of this. Well, you're going to have different styles in every page. You're going to have to load Vue on one page. You're going to have to load React on the other page. It's going to be a terrible user experience. When actually its proponents aren't suggesting that at all. They're suggesting that, you know, people from these different teams coordinate a lot more, but are free to deviate from some kind of grand master architectural plan when it's not suitable for a given task. And done right, I think it means that you have a lot more agility as an engineering organization than you would if you're building this monolithic app where someone can't say, oh, we should use this new tool for this thing. We should use microstates when the rest of the organization is using mm-hmm. Redux. It's not possible. And so you get locked into the decisions of a previous generation.
Right. No, it makes sense. It's funny because my first reaction is like, oh my goodness, the potential for disaster, right? And the klaxon is going to go off in your head. But then you think, well, really then the work is how do you actually manage it so it doesn't become a disaster? And if you can figure that out, then yeah, there is a lot of potential.
Yeah. People always try and solve social problems with technology. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you solve social problems with social solutions.
Right.
You know, talk
right.
to each other.
And I have to imagine it too. It depends on the application, right? Like, you know, I think the Amazon website is developed that way, where they have different teams are responsible for, you know, even down to little content boxes that are up on the toolbar. And that the site doesn't really, it shows, right? It shows this is kind of like slapped together, but that's not what they need. Like they don't need it to not look like there's slight variation with the different ways that they behave. They need to be showing, for their business to work, they need to be showing the right thing at the right time. And that's the overriding concern. So having it look, you know, very beautiful and very coherent isn't necessarily a thing. Same thing. And, you know, Spotify is used as another example of this, right? I didn't know it was called micro front ends, but I know that they've got a similar type thing. But there, clearly, you know, the experience and having it look coherent is more important. And so they make it work somehow, right? And then, like you're saying, it's probably involves groups of people talking to other groups of people about the priorities.
What
for
a
the
radical idea, right?
Right. So, yeah, it doesn't sound to me like just like you're going to adopt micro front ends guarantees one particular set of outcomes. It really is context dependent on what you make of it.
Totally.
I am curious, though. So Svelte, like, so you're essentially, for your reactivity engine, you have to compile to get that reactive behavior. How does that play with other tools? Like when you actually integrate it together, is there any, like, I've never worked with Svelte in a large project, so I can't imagine what it looks like at scale. So I was wondering if you've seen those kind of use cases, and you know what that ends up like, if there's any kind of side effects from that.
As you say, the reactivity within a component is only a local state within that component, or to state that is passed in as a prop from a parent component. But we also have this concept called a store, and a store is just an object that represents a specific value, and you import it from svelte/store. And there are three types of store that you get out of the box: a writable, a readable, and a derived. And a writable is just, you know, var count equals writable parentheses zero. And then you can update that, and you can set it using methods on that store. Inside your markup, you can reference, or in fact inside the script block in the component, you can reference the value of that store just by prefixing it with a dollar sign. And the compiler sees that and says, okay, we need to subscribe to this store's value and then assign it and apply the reactivity. And that is the primary way of having state that exists outside the component hierarchy. Now, I mentioned the writable, readable, and derived are the built-in stores that you get, but you can actually implement your own stores. You just need to implement this very simple contract. And so it's entirely possible to use that API to wrap any state management solution you have. So you can wrap Redux, you can wrap microstates, you can wrap XState, you can wrap whatever it is, whatever your preferred state management solution is. You can adapt it to use with Svelte. And it's very sort of idiomatic and streamlined. Like, it takes care of unsubscriptions when the component is unmounted. All of that stuff is just done for you.
So digging a little bit deeper into the question of integration, like, how difficult would it be to take wholesale components that were implemented in Svelte and kind of integrate them with, you know, some other component framework like React?
If the component is a leaf node, then it's fairly straightforward. Mm-hmm. There is a project called React Svelte, which is, I say project, it's like 20 lines of code. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's actually been updated for Svelte 3, which I should probably do. But that allows you to use a Svelte component in the context of a React application just using the component API, the same way that you would instantiate a Svelte app at the root of your, you know, inside your document.body or whatever. You can do that inside inside a React component. Or you could compile the Svelte component to a web component. And this is one of the great benefits of being a compiler, is that you can target different things. You can generate a regular JavaScript class.
Mm-hmm.
And hey presto, you've got an interactive application. Or you can target a server-side rendering component, which will just generate some HTML for some given state, which can then later be hydrated on the client. Or you can target a web component, which you can use like any other element in the context of any framework at all. And because it's a compiler, because it's discarding all of the bits of the framework that you're not using, it's not like you're bundling an entire framework to go along with your component.
Mm-hmm.
And I should mention, while I'm talking about being able to target different outputs, we can also, there's a native script project, so you can target iOS and Android that same way. Where it gets a little bit more complicated is if it's not a leaf node. If you want to have a React app that contains a Svelte component that has React children, then things start to get a little bit more unwieldy, I think. It's probably technically possible, but I don't know that I would recommend it. But the point is that it is definitely possible to incrementally adopt Svelte inside an existing application, should that be what you need to do.
Now, you said there's a native script project, but it sounds to me like you shouldn't necessarily need native script, right? If you're a compiler, you can actually target Android and you could target iOS directly instead of having native script as an intermediary, right? Or is it?
Yes, if we had the time to do the work, then yes. Like, I think the big thing there would be getting styles to work, because Svelte components have styles,
right?
And you know, in a regular style tag, just as CSS, and you can't just throw CSS at
right.
A native app.
Man, sometimes I feel like it'd be a lot cooler if you could.
So native script really is doing a lot of heavy lifting. Basically, what it's doing is it's providing a fake DOM. So what Svelte native script does is it targets that DOM instead of the real DOM, and then native script turns that into the native instructions.
Okay. Right. And you can do that because you're a compiler.
Compilers has been on our radar for some time, but I'm curious, like, what is your process for figuring out what it should compile to? Like, how do you arrive at the final compile output? Manually having written that code, and then you're like, okay, I'm gonna then write this as I'm gonna now change this to be dynamically generated, or like, how do you figure out what the output should be?
That's pretty much it. Certainly when the project started, it was a case of, you know, I'm going to think like a compiler. I'm going to like hand convert this declarative component code into some frameworkless JavaScript, and then once that's done, sort of work backwards and figure out how a compiler would generate that code. And in the process, you do learn certain things about, you know, what the points of reusability are, which things should be abstracted out into a shared internal helper library, and which things should be generated inline. The whole process is designed to produce output that is easy for a human to understand and reason about. It's not like what you would imagine compiled output to be like. It's not completely inscrutable. It's designed to be, even to the level of being well formatted, it's designed to be something that someone can look at and understand what the compiler was thinking at that moment. And there's definitely ways that we could change and improve it. There are some places where there's more duplication than we need to have. There are some places where we should be using classes instead of closures for performance and memory benefits. But these are all things that, once you've got that base, having gone through that process, that you can begin to iterate on.
It's always curious to me about when is the proper time to move to a compiler, right? Because when you're doing everything at runtime, there's more flexibility there. But at what point do you decide, you know what, I know that these pathways are so well worn that I'm going to lay down pavement, and I'm going to write a compiler. Like, what was the decision process in your mind about, okay, now it's time? Because I think that's maybe not a thought that occurs to most of us, is like, I have to write a compiler for this. Like, is this something that people should do more often?
the meme of this should be a compiler is one that is worth sort of having at the back of your head. Like, I think there are a lot of opportunities that not just in the UI framework space, but in general, like, mm-hmm. is there some way that we can take this work that is currently happening at runtime and shift it into a step that only happens once?
Mm-hmm.
That obviously benefits users, and very often we find it benefits developers as well. I don't think there was a point at which I said, oh, this stuff that's happening at runtime should be happening at compile time. It was more, I mean, the actual origin has felt it was a brain worm that someone else infected me with some months prior. They've been talking about, this Jed Schmidt is a very well-known figure in the JavaScript world. He'd been working on this exact idea, but hadn't taken it to the point where he was ready to open source it. But he'd shared like his findings and the general idea, and I was just immediately smitten with this concept of getting rid of the framework runtime. At the time, the big conversation happening in the JavaScript community was about the fact that we're shipping too much JavaScript and it's affecting startup performance time. And so the initial thought was, well, maybe we can solve that problem by just not having the runtime. And so that was the starting point for Svelte. Over time, I've come to realize that that is maybe not the main benefit. That is just one of the benefits that you get from this approach. You also get much faster update performance because you don't have to do this fairly expensive virtual DOM diffing process. Lately, I've come to think that the biggest win from it is that you can write a lot less code. If you're a compiler, then you're not kind of hemmed in by the constraints of the language. So you can almost invent your own language. And if you can do that, then you can do the same things that you would have been doing with an API in the language itself. And that's the basis of our system of reactivity, for example. So we can build these apps that are smaller and by extension, less bug prone and more maintainable. I just wanted to quickly address the point you made about flexibility. This is a theoretical downside of being a compiler. We're throwing away the constraints about the code needing to be something that runs in the browser, but we're adding a constraint, which is that the code needs to be statically analyzable. And in theory, that results in a loss of flexibility. In practice, we haven't found that to affect the things that we can build. And I think that a lot of times when people have this conversation, they're focusing on the sort of academic concepts of flexibility. But what matters is, what can you build? How easy is it to build a certain thing? And so if empirically you find that you're not restricted in the things that you can build, and you can build the same things much faster, then that academic notion of flexibility doesn't, to my mind, have any real value.
You know, hearing you talk reminded me of kind of a quote that I heard that always stuck with me back from early in my career when I came into programming through Perl. Perl was my first language. Perl is a very weird language, but among other things, you can actually just change the way that Perl parses code. Like you can write Perl that makes Perl not Perl, if that makes any sense. And when asked about this feature, the guy Larry Wall who came up with Perl, he's like, well, you program Perl, but really what you're doing is you're programming Perl with a set of semantics that you've negotiated with the compiler. And that was kind of a funny way of saying, like, you get to extend the compiler yourself. Here's like the default set of things that you can do with our compiler. But if you want to, you know, tweak it or add or modify, you can do that. And so you can utilize the function, you know, the same functionality that makes it powerful in the first place. You can kind of inject that whole mode of operation into the entire workflow. Does that make sense? Like, so that's a long way of saying, have you thought about, and is it possible to kind of extend the Svelte compiler as part of a customization or as part of the Svelte programming experience?
We have a very rudimentary version of that, which is pre-processing. There's an API that comes with Svelte called pre-process. And the idea is that you can pass in some code and it will do some very basic, like it will extract your styles, it will extract your scripts, and it will extract your markup. And then it will give you the opportunity to replace those things with something else. So for example, you could write some futuristic JavaScript and then compile it with Babel before it gets passed to the Svelte compiler, which uses Acorn and therefore needs to be able to have valid JavaScript so that it can construct an abstract syntax tree. A more extreme version of that, people can use Pug to write their markup instead of HTML. Mm-hmm. You can use Sass and Less and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
generally I don't recommend that people do, because it adds these moving parts and it makes a lot of bug reports are people just trying to figure out how to get these different moving parts to operate together. And it's, I don't know, it means that your editor plugins can't understand what's inside your style tag all of a sudden and stuff like that. So it definitely adds some complexity, but it is possible. At the other end, at a slightly more extreme level, we have talked about making the code generation part pluggable. So that, for example, the default renderer and the SSR renderer are just two examples of something that plugs into the compiler that says, here is the component, here's the abstract syntax tree, here's some metadata about like which values are in scope, all of this stuff, and then go away and generate some code from this. And we haven't done that so far, partly because there hasn't been a great demand for it, but also because it's really complicated. As soon as you turn something into a plugin platform, you just magnify the number of connection points and the number of ways that things could go wrong by an order of magnitude. And so we've been a little bit wary of doing that, but it is something that we've talked about, primarily in the context of being able to do new and interesting things like target WebGL directly or target the command line. Like, there are renderers for React that let you build command line apps using React components. And like we've talked about, maybe we should be able to do that. Native is another example. You know, the native script integration, as you say, it could be replaced with the compiler doing that work directly. But that, for that to work presently, that would mean that all of that logic would need to sit in core. And it would be nice if that could be just another extension to the compiler. But this is, you know, we're talking about a lot of engineering effort, and there's higher priority items on our to-do list at the moment. So it's filed under one day.
Mm-hmm. Right. And what are those high priority items?
The biggest thing I think at the moment is TypeScript integration. Surprisingly, this is probably like the number one feature request, I think, is that people want to be able to write TypeScript inside their Svelte components, and they want to be able to get TypeScript when they import a Svelte component into something else. They want to be able to get completion hints and type checking and all the rest of it. And
right,
a couple of years ago, that would have been more or less unthinkable. But now it's like table stakes, is that you have to have first-class TypeScript support.
Yeah, TypeScript is it's as popular as Babel these days, right?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, I don't need to be sold on the benefits. I've been using TypeScript a lot myself. Mm-hmm. Svelte is written in TypeScript, but actually being able to write it inside your components is something that would involve us hacking around with the TypeScript compiler API in a way that I don't know if anyone actually, or any of us on the team, actually knows how to do. So we just need to spend some time and do that. But, you know, obviously when you've got an open source project, you need to deal with the bugs that arise and stuff first. So it's difficult to find time to do a big project like that.
So, you know, devil's advocate here is, if the compiler was open for extension, couldn't TypeScript support be just another plugin?
It could, but then you could end up with a situation where there's multiple competing TypeScript plugins and no one's sure which one to use, and they all have slightly different characteristics. I always think it's better if these things that are common feature requests that a lot of people will benefit from, if they're built into the project itself. Like, I really like the batches included way of developing. And I think this is something that we've sort of drifted away from in the front end world over the last few years. We've drifted away from batches included towards do it yourself.
Assemble the entire thing, right? Step one, open the box and pour the 1,000 Lego pieces onto the floor.
Yeah. But it's worse than that, because at least with a Lego set, you get the Lego pieces. It's like if you had the Lego manual showing you how to build something, but you were then responsible for going out and getting the Lego pieces. That's front-end development, and I don't like it.
Right. Yeah. No, I don't like that either. I mean, there's a lot of people advocating directly. You really ought to be doing everything completely and totally yourself.
Yeah.
And a lot of software development shops still operate that way.
Yeah. You know, I find that the people advocating for that position the most loudly, they tend to be the maintainers of the projects in question. Mm-hmm. The whole small modules philosophy exists for the benefit primarily of library authors and framework authors, not for the benefit of developers, much less users. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the people who are building libraries and frameworks tend to have the loudest megaphones means that that mindset, that philosophy, is taken as a best practice for the industry as a whole. And I think it's a mistake to think that way.
There is also, I think, a degree of a sliding scale where you start off with, like, as a more experience you get, because there is more experience you get, closer you get to that kind of wanting granular control, and then it kind of slides down towards granular control and then slides back up to, like, you know, once you got a lot of experience, you're like, okay, I don't want this control anymore.
Yeah.
You know, and then you kind of casp that and you get into, like, I'm now responsible for tools that my team uses, and now you're back to wanting that control because you want things to be able to click together, right? So it's kind of like a wave that your interest in that might change over time depending on your, like, experience level and your position in the organization. So yeah, there's definitely different, like, motivating factors. Like, one of the things that we've been thinking a lot about is designing tools that are granular at the composable and granular at individual module level, but combined together into a system for consumption, you know, in regular people. So, like, finding those primitives that will just click together when you know how to click them together, right? But when you're consuming them, just feel like a holistic whole, but at the same time not being monolithic. Like, that's a lot of things to figure out, and it's a lot of things to manage over time. Yeah. But that's the kind of things we've been thinking about a lot.
I think that's what distinguishes the good projects that are going to have a long lifespan from the projects that, you know, are maybe interesting but don't have a long shelf life, is whether they're designed in such a way that permits that kind of cohesion and innovation trade-off. If we think of it as a trade-off, you know, anyone can build the fastest thing or the smallest thing or the whatever it is thing, but building these things in a way that feels like it was designed holistically but is also flexible enough to be used with everything else that you use, that's the real design challenge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know where to draw that line. You know, maybe one good example of this, and, you know, these are actually two projects that I'm not particularly a fan of, but I think they do a good job of operating this way. So I guess in that sense, you know, it means I can even be more honest about it. Like, I don't particularly care for Redux or, like, observables, but, you know, we ended up using, in one of our last React projects, we had to choose between using Redux Saga and Redux Observable. And the Redux Observable worked very well for us. And I think one of the reasons is because they both had to kind of exist. They had to kind of coexist as their own projects. Yeah. Like, Redux exists as its own entity, and Observables exist as their own kind of whole. They have a whole ecosystem. And so they put a lot of thought in, like, what is the natural way in which these two primitives compose together? As opposed to Saga, which, and I don't want to disparage the project, because I think it actually is a really good project. There's a lot of really good ideas there, but because it's more like just bolted on to Redux, and it doesn't exist outside of the ecosystem of, yeah, Redux, and the ideas can't flourish outside and figure out how it interfaces with other things, like, the true primitive is still unrevealed there. Right. And so, whereas what I feel like with Redux, you actually have two really, really true primitives. Now, they're not necessarily my favorite primitives, but they are very refined and very, like, these do exactly what they are meant to do. And so when you find how they connect together, that experience is also really good. And the primitive that arises there, I think, ends up being better.
Yeah.
Is that an example of what you guys are talking about? Maybe.
Yeah, no, I think so. I mean, right. It's distilling to the essence, the core of what you try to do, and then be able to combine it together. I mean, that's been kind of the thing that I've been working, that we've been working on the front side on, but I'm also, and then within this context, like, it makes me think of, like, how does a compiler fit into that? Like, how does that work with the compiler, right? Like, it's just like, when you add the compiler element, it just makes it, like, my mind just goes, how does that work together?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. That's why I keep coming back to, like, how do you, you know, and maybe I haven't, you know, you just have to kind of go through the experience, but it feels like maybe there's this cycle of, like, you build up the framework, and then once it's well understood, you throw the framework away in favor of, like, just wiring it straight in there with the compiler, and then you iterate on that process. Is that fair to say? Like,
kind of, yeah. We're sort of going through this at the moment. I'm working on this project. So I referred a moment ago to being able to target WebGL directly. At the moment, the approach that I'm taking to building WebGL apps is to have WebGL components inside Svelte. And it's a project called SvelteGL. And we've used it a couple of times at the Times. It's not really production ready yet, but I think it has some promise. But it's also slightly inefficient in that, like, it needs to have all of the shader code available for, like, whichever path you're going to take, whatever characteristics your materials have, you need to have all of the shader code. And if we're smart about it, then the compiler could know ahead of time which bits of shader code it needed to include. At the moment, it just doesn't have a way of figuring that out. And so that would be an example of paving those cow paths. Like, if you do try and do everything within the compiler universe, it does restrict your freedom of movement. It's true. And, you know, to qualify my earlier statements about how the small modules philosophy is to the benefit of authors over developers, it has actually enabled this huge flourishing of innovation, particularly in the React world. We've got this plethora of different state management solutions and CSS and JS solutions. And while I, as a developer, probably don't want to deal with that, I just want there to be a single correct answer. Mm-hmm. It's definitely been to the advantage of the ecosystem as a whole to have all of this experimentation done in the wild that projects like Svelte can then take advantage of. We can say, oh, well, having observed all of this, this is the right way to solve this problem. And so, like, we can kind of bake in that and take advantage of the research that other people have done. And, you know, I think we have made contributions of our own, but there is a lot of stuff in Svelte, like the fact that data generally flows one way instead of having two-way bindings everywhere. Like, things like that are the results of having seen everyone make mistakes in the past and learning from them. So there are trade-offs all around.
One thing that, on topic of data flowing here and there, one thing that I've been kind of struggling to compute is the impact of that, as opposed to something where you have like one directional data flow. Because it seems like conceptually it's really simple. You set a property like in two-way bound system, like it just like propagates through stuff. But what you don't really have a way is you don't have any way of assessing what is the true impact of that computation, like what is the cost of that propagation. Where I think it's almost easier to see the cost of that computation if you have like one directional data flow, because you know that essentially everything between the moment that you invoke the transition to computing the next state, that is the cost of your computation. Right. Where you don't have that way of computing the result in a two-way bound system, like in something like Ember Run Loop or like MobX or zones, like Vue's reactive system, like all these systems make it really difficult to understand what is the real cost of setting state. And that's something that I personally find difficult, because this clarity that you have about the one directional data flow and what it takes to compute the next state, it's almost like, because that cost is tangible, where you're thinking about, like, you know, mutation of objects and tracking their change, like that cost is almost immeasurable. Like, it just seems like a blob of changes that they have to propagate. I don't know. That's just something that I've been thinking a lot, because especially with the work that we've been doing with microstates, because it's, as you're figuring out what the next state is, you know exactly what operations are performed in a process, where that might not be the case with a system that tracks changes, like what you would have with zones or with Ember Run Loop or Vue.
Yeah, I would agree with that. The times that I found it to be beneficial to deviate from the top-down ideology is when, you know, you have things like form elements and you want to bind to the values of those form elements. You want to use them in some other computation. And when you do all that by having props going in and then events going out and then you intercept the event and then you set the prop, you're basically articulating what the compiler can articulate for you more effectively anyway. And so conceptually, we have two-way bindings within Svelte, but mechanically, everything is top-down, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is it because you can analyze the tree of top-down and saying, like, and basically understanding when you can cheat, right? Because if you know, and this might be really, really oversimplistic, but it's, you know, if you're kind of with the event, you're collecting the water and then you have to put it way up in top of the thing and, you know, it flows down. But, you know, if you can see the entire apparatus, you can say, well, actually, I've got this water and it's going to end up here. So I'm just going to, I'm just going to cheat and put it over right there. Is that the type of thing that you're talking about, where you're effectively getting a two-way binding, but you're just kind of you're skipping the ceremony.
It's kind of writing the exact same code that you would write if you were doing it using events. But it's, if you were writing it yourself, then maybe you would do something in a slightly inefficient way, perhaps. Or, you know, for example, with some kinds of bindings, you have to be careful to avoid an infinite loop. If, you know, you have an event that triggers a state change, well, the state change could trigger the event again, and you get this infinite loop. A compiler can guard against that. It can say, this is a binding that could have that problem, so we're going to just keep track of whether this state change is a result of a binding. And so the compiler can sort of solve all of these really hairy problems that you would face as a developer, while also giving you the like the benefit in terms of being able to write much less code and write code that expresses the relationship between these two things in a more semantic and declarative way, like without the danger.
Yeah, this is part of the reason why I was so excited to talk to you about this stuff, Rich, because it's this stuff is really interesting. I mentioned that we might, so we have a little bit more time, so I just wanted to mention, because I think that you might find this interesting, the structured concurrency stuff that we were talking about, that I mentioned to you before. So I'm just gonna, I want to let Charles talk about it briefly, because it's interesting, because it essentially comes down to managing asynchrony, as it ties to life cycle of objects. And this is something, life cycle of objects and components is something we deal with on a regular basis. So it's been interesting exercise and experimenting with that. So Charles, you want to give kind of a lowdown?
Sure. I mean, I guess it's definitely something that I'm very excited about. So Tras gets to hear like an earful pretty much every day. But, you know, the idea behind structured concurrency, I don't know, if you're familiar with it. It's something that I read a fantastic. So people have been using this for a while in the Ember community. So Alex Matchner, who's a friend and oftentimes guest on the podcast, created a library called Ember Concurrency, where he brought these ideas of structured concurrency to the Ember world. But it's actually, you know, it's very prevalent. There's C libraries and Python libraries. There's not a generic one for JavaScript yet. But the idea is just really taking the same concepts of scope that you have with variables and with components, whether they be, you know, Ember components, Svelte components, React components, or whatever, that there's, you have a tree of components, or you have a, you know, a tree of parents and children, and modeling every single asynchronous process as a tree, rather than what we have now, which is kind of parallel linear stacks. So, you know, you call some tick happens in the event loop, and you drill down, and you either edit an exception, or you go straight back up. You know, the next tick of the event loop comes, you drill down to some stack, and then you go back up. A promise resolves, you do that stack. And so with structured concurrency, you can have, you know, essentially every stack can have multiple children. And so you can fork off multiple children. But if you have, you know, if you have an error in any of these children, it's going to, you know, propagate up the entire tree. And so, you know, it's essentially the same idea as components, except it's applied to concurrent processes. And you can do some just really, really amazing things, because you don't ever have to worry about some process, you know, going rogue, and you don't have to worry about coordinating all these different event loops. And one of the things that I'm discovering is that I don't need like event loops. I don't really use promises anymore. Like it's actually, I was watching your talk when you're talking about Svelte 3, when you're like virtual DOM, or maybe it was, did you write a blog post about, you know, we got to stop saying that virtual DOMs are fast?
Yes, I did.
So I think it was that one. I was reading that one and it kind of, it jibed with me, because you were like, why can't we just go and do the work? Like we've got the event, we can just do the work. And one of the things that I'm discovering is with using the structured concurrency with generators, I'm experiencing a very similar phenomenon where these stack traces, like if there's an error, the stack trace is like three lines long, because right, you're basically, you're doing the work and you're executing all these stacks and you're pausing them with a generator. And then when an event happens, you just resume right where you left off. There's no like, okay, you know, we've got this event, let's push it into this event queue that's waiting behind these three like event loops, and then we're draining these queues one at a time. It's like, nope, the event happens. You can just resume right where you were. You're in the middle of a function call, in the middle of like a try-catch block. You know, you just go without any ceremony, without any fuss. You just go straight to where you were, and the stack and the context and all the variables and everything is there preserved exactly where you left it. So it's really like you're just taking the book right off the shelf and, you know, going but right to your bookmark and continuing along, rather than, you know, when you've got things like the run loop in Ember or the zones in Angular, where you have all these mechanics to reconstruct the context of where you were, you know, to make sure that you don't have some event listener that, you know, an event listener is created inside of a context, and making sure that that context is either reconstructed or the event listener doesn't fire. Like, all these problems just cease to exist when you take this approach. And so if it's pertinent to this conversation, that was a surprising result for me, was that if you're using essentially coroutines to manage your concurrency, it, like, you don't need event loops, you don't need buffers, you don't need any of this other stuff. You just use the JavaScript call stack, and that's enough.
I'm not going to pretend to have fully understood everything you just said, but it does sound interesting. Svelte does have something not that dissimilar to Ember's run loop, because if you have two state changes right next to each other, x plus equals one, y plus equals one, like, you want to have a single update resulting from those. So instead of instruments in the code such that your components are updated immediately after x plus equals one, it waits until the end of the event loop, and then it will flush all of the pending changes simultaneously. Mm-hmm. So what you're describing sounds quite wonderful, and I want to understand it better. You have also reminded me that Alex Machner implemented this idea in Svelte. It's called Svelte Concurrency. And when mm-hmm. he sent it to me, I was out in the woods somewhere, and I couldn't take a look at it. And so it went on my mental to-do list, and I'm and you just brought it to the top of that to-do list. So we have some common ground here, I think.
All right.
This is really, really fascinating conversation. Thank you, Richard, so much for joining us.
Thank you for listening. If you or someone you know has something to say about building user interfaces that simply must be heard, please get in touch with us. We can be found on Twitter at @thefrontside or over just plain old email at contact@frontside.io. Thanks, and see you next time.